An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Oh, Heart Sutra. And if anybody's interested, every time we have a one-day sitting or longer sitting, when we do the service, we chant the Heart Sutra in Japanese. Hint, hint. So I don't know how much you've read. I don't want to go into a long introduction, but the Heart Sutra is shortest of what are called the Wisdom Sutras, the Prajnaparamita Sutras. And they there are a lot of them. And one of them is 8,000 lines. I think there's one even longer. And the Heart Sutra is thought of as the shortest one. Except there's an even shorter one, which is simply Ah. We would call it the letter A, which is a negative, which you know if you think about it. You've heard of somebody being afebrile, meaning without fever. And anyway, so the Heart Sutra is usually thought of as the shortest one because the A is, it's sort of cute, tricky. The longer one, there's 100,000 line or 100, I don't know, but the usual one is Prajnaparamita in 8,000 lines. There's also something called the Diamond Sutra, which we studied a while ago and maybe will again at some point. It's wonderful. It's famous for all the negatives. It's negative in a different way. The Heart Sutra, of course, is full of no. And if you chant it in Japanese, you'll notice it says moo all the time. And you may have heard of the koan moo, which is mu, which is sort of negative. The Diamond Sutra, there comes over and over and over again. Buddha says, Have I taught the Four Noble Truths? And then I think it's Shariputra, and one of the disciples says, No, Lord, you have not taught the Four Noble Truths as no truths have you taught it. And then he says, Therefore have I taught the Four Noble Truths. And it just goes on and on and on and on and on. Did this happen? No, 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 no. Therefore, this happened. The Heart Sutra is part of that. It is part of what we call the Mahayana. Now, yeah, I want to, if I say anything that you don't understand, if I use a term of art or something like that, please, you can just raise your hand, put your hands in gusho. I'll probably see it, and you don't fill my screen, so it's all right. You can also use the reactions button on the bottom, and a hand will show up, and so that's also possible. But I might or might not notice that. Anyway, it's part of this wisdom tradition, which grew out of Mahayana practice, I think. Does everybody know what Mahayana means? If you don't, would you raise your hand if you want me to talk about it? Okay. It's early practice. It means great vehicle. Maha means great. And it's it's probably, it just got complicated when I first learned about such things, things they were much simpler. Now we don't know that it was a later development, that it, but it was a parallel development to what we now call Nikaya Buddhism. Nikayas are the sutras, the teachings of the historical Buddha. And they used to, it used to be called Hinayana, which means lesser vehicle. So we try not to use that anymore. But you may have heard that. Theravada practice grows out of that too. But we now call it Nikaya Buddhism. But there were people that grew out of that, that promulgated, I guess, an analysis, something called the Abhidharma. And people involved with the Abhidharma made a lot of lists, a lot of lists. Kate, that's probably where the analysis of how many moments there are came out of those people. And there are lists of wholesome dharmas and lists of unwholesome dharmas. And, I can't remember, but a lot. There's a lot. And so there was the what happens when you start making lists is that you start reifying your lists. You start believing in your lists. You become attached to your lists. Reifying means concretizing, thingifying. And you begin to think that they have these dharmas, small d dharmas, have their own being. And so the Mahayana wisdom tradition was developed in part as a reaction to that, as a, I would say, a correction to it, to say, no, nothing. There aren't some kind of separate list of dharmas that are permanent. There isn't anything permanent. No. And that's the impetus, maybe, or at least part of it, for these wisdom sutras and this development of the Prajnaparamita analysis. And I'm not going to get much into the quantum physics, except that I will read one of the descriptions of emptiness in there, in what Musong wrote. I think, Paula, was it you that contacted him? Anyway, he gave us permission to copy this. What we sent you was it's like the first, he has a book now. It's old, it's been around for a while, but he developed this into an actual book. But this was like a working draft, and he kindly let us use it. So I figured it was all right to go ahead and copy the whole thing, share the whole thing. Which, working with lawyers who do copyright law and so on, I try to be conscious of fair use. So I will use it a little bit. But the school, I think that it's Musang that says this, that when Mahayana really entered into Chinese society, they called it the Prajnaparamita Sutra, or the Prajnaparamita School. And the Prajnaparamita is the perfection of wisdom. And we have a statue of her here in a niche. Just as you go from the Zendo into the hallway, she's there. And she was an ordination present to me from a friend at the Berkeley Zen Center, a woman named Rebecca Maieno, who was a ceramicist and a sculptor. And Prajna means wisdom, as you probably know, but it is not the wisdom of book learning. It's the intuitive, experiential wisdom that we have and that our effort is to open to, right? Prajna. And paramita means perfection. Perfection of wisdom. So prajna, paramita, the perfection of wisdom. But again, it doesn't mean so much. I guess you could say that she herself, prajna paramita, is the perfection of wisdom, and she really is perfect. But for the rest of us, the paramitas, and the particularly the prajna paramita, means that we are working to perfect it. That it's a process that you practice the piano in order to perfect your ability to play Bach. Right? So you are perfecting it. And it's not about having a goal and it's not about being able to play Bach, but it's having that wholeheartedness. And there is, in the long version of this, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, there is a thing that we chant when we do a longer service and sesshins and all. And it's the homage to the Prajnaparamita. And I forget who, somebody was studying it and discovered this part of it. And so we started chanting it, both at San Francisco Zen Center and Berkeley. So it's like, homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. The perfection of wisdom gives light. Unstained, the entire world cannot stain her. She is a source of light, and from everyone in the triple world, she removes darkness. Most excellent are her works. She brings light so that all fear and distress may be forsaken, and disperses the gloom and darkness of delusion. She herself is an organ of vision. She has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, for she does not stray away from it. She has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, for she doesn't stray away from it. The perfection of wisdom of the Buddhas sets in motion the wheel of the dharma. So she is sometimes called the mother of the Buddhas. And she is an organ of vision. She sees clearly. She sees, as Suzuki Roshi used to say, and Mel loved to quote, she sees things as it is. Things as it is. And she knows the own being of all dharmas. They don't have any. We don't have any. There isn't any. And she really knows it. We forget. And that's the major point of the Heart Sutra. Now, the first sentence of the Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra is Avalokiteshvara, when practicing deeply the Prajna Paramita, perceived that all five skandhas in their own being are empty, and was saved from all suffering. So he saw what she sees, that they are empty. And we need to, I don't want to say this. The Heart Sutra, as you've noticed, includes some lists, some really basic teaching, including the five skandhas or aggregates, no form, no feeling, no perception, no formation, no consciousness in that particular translation. That's by Kanze, by the way, Conze, famous translator. He came to San Francisco Zen Center many years ago and translated a lot of the chants into English, because all they had was had was Japanese, or I guess Chinese. Anyway, so it opens with all the skandhas in their own being are empty. And it's useful to have some understanding of what are the skandhas and what are these other lists that are embodied, you know, no eyes, no ears, no nose, and so on, and no ignorance and no extinction of it until no old age and death and no extinction of that and so on. These are lists of really, really, really basic teachings. And the Abhidharma folks had latched onto them and gotten to the point where they started to see them as permanent things. And so the Sart Sutra is trying to correct that. But we also need to, it's useful to have some idea of what these basic dharmas are. It also includes the Four Noble Truths, which was Buddha's first teaching. So Steve is going to talk about this, those lists in the next class, but I asked him if he would review the five skandhas for us so we know what we're talking about, being nothing. So Steve?
Sure. So so again, the five skandhas are form, feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness. And form is also rupa, which is that's a Sanskrit, I think. And basically that's the material world, to kind of oversimplify it. It was thought of as maybe the similar to the five or four elements, earth, wind, fire, water. I think today we might think of it as, say, the periodic table of the elements. But also, more traditionally in Buddhism, it's all of our senses that make up the world. So our eyes and what we see, and our so our five senses and our mind. In Buddhism, there are six senses. And the mind has objects, just like the eye has sight, and the ear has sound, etc. The second element, the second of the skandhas, is vedana in Sanskrit, feelings in English, in the translation we're using. Now, vedana is actually one that I've struggled a little bit to understand. And one thing, Mary, we talked to, this was Charlie, I think. Charlie Pokorny. I actually was going to ask you before we started, but he is a scholar, he had a great answer. What is his, just want to give him proper credit.
Charlie is a Zen priest. He is one of the teachers at the Stone Creek Zen Center in Grayton, right near Sevastopol. And he received Dharma transmission from Reb Anderson. And he is a scholar, and he teaches I'm not sure. One of the, you know, he part of the theological seminary at Berkeley. They have all these different schools, and so I don't remember which one, but he teaches there. So he's a professor also.
Right. So we asked him a question, and I actually, funny thing is, I don't remember what my exact question is, but I still have his answer, which is pretty helpful. I was just trying to distinguish what is feelings as opposed to the other skandhas. And basically one of the things it is our perceptions of, and I shouldn't use the word perception because that's another skandha in English, so forgive me, please. So feelings, it's something that's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And it is it's like something that we move toward or away from. That's why it's separated out on its own. because it's really related to suffering. It's related to grasping. So greed, hate, delusion, which are three very important concepts in Buddhism, and feeling corresponds to positive, negative, or neutral feelings. So, and it relates to the senses, but we're kind of in the realm of the mind now, because the form, although there's some crossover, so I don't want you to think that we have body and form and the rest of them are fully mind, but we're more in the realm of the mind, but we're not strictly in the mind. So the next one after feelings is perceptions, which is samjna in Sanskrit. That's basically our concepts. So it's when you sense something and you conceptualize, oh, that's a chair, that's a clock. And it's our basically our conceptual mind is the way that we categorize things. The next skanda is formations, which means mental formations, which also used to confuse me. I always thought that meant concepts, but really it's more like impulses. That's samskara or formations is what impels us by karma. So again, it's moving toward or away from things, but it's really in our thought formation. So it's not just the chair, but it's, I don't want to sit on that chair. It's cold, something like that. They can as well be positive, negative, or neutral, and create positive, neutral, or negative karma. And then finally is consciousness, and that's the fifth skanda, all known as vijnana. And consciousness is, now this I see all everywhere, I see warnings, don't think of this as something special, even though in the reading I gave you, it says that it's traditionally called the mind lord, but don't be misled by that. It's not some special consciousness like spirit. It's not anything like that. It's not the king of the body or something like that. What it is like each of, it's actually before you get to the concepts, and it's before you get to something besides that. So it's your eyes, when they see something, then there's the consciousness of seeing. When you hear something, there's a consciousness of hearing. And when your mind focuses on an object, you know, a thought or an emotion, then there's the awareness, the consciousness of that. And the point, of course, is that of the Heart Sutra is that if you look in any of these skandhas, you're not going to find a self. This thing we call the ego is an illusion, because you look to all parts of the human personality, and they're all empty of any kind of self or own being, as we're saying. Do you want to add anything to that, Mary?
No, I think when I think of feelings, I kind of think, and I never talked to Charlie about this, but it's almost like the autonomic nervous system. So it's the initial impulse, the subconscious maybe, or the body reacts. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not going through some thought process, even though that of course is instantaneous, but it just, you know, if you're hot and it's cool breeze, it feels good. You know, and then you think about it. But anyway, something like that.
Yeah, I actually wrote in my notes. Yeah. Sorry, I actually wrote in my notes things that I didn't mention, but that are very consistent with that. As I was trying to decide how to describe feelings, I wrote, no judgment is before judgment arises, and it's the bare sense, including the mind sense. So yeah. It feels like I do have a similar sense to you.
Yeah, I think so. Well, you should, since we talked about that particular one. Both.
Yeah, we talked about that a lot.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. So those skandhas in their own being are empty. They don't have own being. which brings us, of course, to emptiness. Nothing has own being. And I am going to read what Musang quotes from The Silent Pulse. And bear in mind that even this is reifying. However, I like the feeling of it, because he comes back to saying it's just a dance, and there's nothing, you know, this electron microscope keeps getting closer and closer and closer, and then it gets to the nucleus, and even turns out that even the nucleus of an atom is just energy. So I think it gives you a little bit of a feel for emptiness, because emptiness, it's not a thing. It is not a characteristic. It's not really describable. You know, you can't say it's a characteristic. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Dogen says, you shouldn't even say that. You should say form is form. I think Suzuki Roshi says that too. Just say form. And emptiness is there. Just say emptiness and form is there. Don't separate them, because they can't be separated. And we have, you know, we have a hardwired need to reify our experience and make a thing of it and label it. We want to know what it is. We want a name for it. I cook, you know, and I just make things up, or I start with something and then I make something else. And then people always want to know what it's called. I don't know what it's called. It's dinner, you know. Anyway, so I'm going to read from page 11. The electron scanning microscope with the power to magnify. Well, actually, why don't we, does somebody have it in front of, do you have it with you?
Sorry, page 11 of what?
The Musang, the Heart Sutra in Light of Quantum Reality.
Oh, this thing?
It looks like a piece of paper to me. See what Raymond has?
Ancient Buddhism, Wisdom in the Light of Quantum Reality, that thing that you guys sent to us. Okay, I got that.
That's the one, Jogi.
Okay. So, Raymond, what you have, is that the book? It's the actual book, or you have the thing that we sent?
It's the actual book.
So I think this is in there, but I'm not sure. It's page 11, the electron scanning microscope with the power.
Yeah, it does. The pages do not match.
No, but you have that quote.
So I don't know where that is.
Oh, okay. So somebody have
on page 12 of the handout.
Okay.
As they were numbered when they were printed for me, anyway.
I have it, Mary.
Okay. Well, what I just want a couple of people to read it. So that's why I'm asking. So to some, Kate could read the first two paragraphs and the first three paragraphs. And then the other person could read through the real short paragraph on the next, the winds up being, I think, on the next page of what is the body made.
Okay, so you want me to start with the electron scanning microscope?
Yeah.
All right. the electron scanning microscope with the power to magnify several thousand times takes us down into a realm that has the look of the sea about it. In the kingdom of corpuscles, there is transfiguration and there is samsara, the endless round of birth and death. Every passing second, some 2.5 million red cells are born. Every second, the same number die. The typical cell lives about 110 days, then becomes tired and decrepit. There are no lingering deaths here, for when a cell loses its vital force, it somehow attracts the attention of macrophage. As the magnification increases, the flesh does begin to dissolve. Muscle fiber now takes on a fully crystalline aspect. We can see that it is made of long spiral molecules in orderly array. And all of these molecules are swaying like wheat in the wind, connected with one another and held in place by invisible waves that pulse many trillions of times a second. What are the molecules made of? As we move closer, we see atoms, the tiny shadowy balls dancing around their fixed locations in the molecules, sometimes changing position with their partners in perfect rhythms. And now we focused on one of the atoms. Its interior is lightly veiled by a cloud of electrons. We come closer, increasing the magnification. The shell dissolves and we look on the inside to find nothing.
Somebody want to continue? Somebody willing to continue?
Read, this is Jody.
Okay, so somewhere, so there are two medium and then that real short paragraph and that's the place to stop.
So just the one paragraph somewhere within, right?
No, somewhere within these days of what?
Oh, these ways, okay. Somewhere within that emptiness we know is a nucleus. We scan the space and there it is, a tiny dot. At last, we have discovered something hard and solid, a reference point. But no, as we move closer to the nucleus, it too begins to dissolve. It too is nothing more than an oscillating field, waves of rhythm. Inside the nucleus are other organized fields, protons, neutrons, even smaller particles. Each of these upon our approach also dissolve into pure rhythm. These days, they, the scientists, are looking for quarks, strange subatomic entities having qualities which they describe with such words as upness, downness, charm, strangeness, truth, beauty, color, and flavor. But no matter, if we could get close enough to these wondrous quarks, they too would melt away. They too would have to give up all pretense of solidity. Even their speed and relationship would be unclear, leaving them only relationship and pattern of vibration. Of what is the body made? It is made of emptiness and rhythm. At the ultimate heart of the body, at the heart of the world, there is no solidity. Once again, there is only the dance. At the imaginable, at the... Okay.
I cannot resist T.S. Eliot. Drive the point home. This is from the Four Quartets from Burr to Norton. This is a really famous quote. At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is, but neither arrest nor movement. And do not call it fixity, where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline, except for the point, the still point. There would be no dance, and there is only the dance. So That's how it is. You know, we talk about the two truths, right? There's the relative truth and the absolute truth. And the absolute truth is that there is just the dance. There's just change and interconnection. There's no I, there's no you, there's no table, there's no dog. There's no books. I will stop. I could make an Abhidharma list, but I will stop. I'll control myself. There just is. And that there's the relative truth of me and you and books and words and thoughts and getting up in the morning and sitting zazen, eating breakfast. These are not two. We make them two because we grab on to the relative world. We have to live in it. We have to talk. We function. We have to eat breakfast. We have to use the bathroom and so on. We don't have to, and this is what the Heart Sutra is insisting on. We don't have to make a thing of it. There isn't any thing. It's not nothing. It's no thing. It's not, there's no solidity. There's no own being is another way of saying there's no essence. There's no ultimate redness. There's just a dance. And we make our lives and other people's lives difficult because we believe what we think. We believe what we seem to experience. That's a woman who leads the caregivers support group for caregivers of people with dementia says about them. She says sometimes reminds us not to argue about things because she says they know what they know. Well, so do we. We know what we know, and we think we know it. But the Heart Sutra is telling us, no, no, you don't. Sometimes I feel like it's kind of like saying, no, no, stop it, drop. I was looking to see if the dog would raise her head when I said drop. But she didn't. But that's emptiness. And it is the heart of our practice, this no eyes, no ears, no nose. Of course you have eyes and ears and nose. And of course you have an ego. And of course you have opinions. But you could let them go. And that is our practice. And out of that, out of all that, no, 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 no. The more we can open the hand of thought rather than live by the grasping hand of thought, we can find real compassion. The Heart Sutra is not just about emptiness. It's about compassion, which the more you know emptiness, the more you experience it, the more you can also allow compassion to arise because you stop clinging to your own ideas and you stop being self-protective or as self-protective. I mean, none of us is quite going to be Buddha probably this lifetime, but you loosen the grip and then compassion can arise because you naturally, you know, connection. You know that we're not separate. So the appropriate compassionate response arises naturally. Like Obora talks about, you know, laughter or tears with no traces. They're coming just straight from I don't know, your gut, your heart, whatever, but it's an empty heart. And we feel like that's the theme of what we're talking about in this class is what is an empty heart? And how do you get one? And of course you can't get one. That's the whole point of it. You have to sit still and see how much harm you're causing by not letting go. And then that encourages you to let go. Right? Okamura says that the Heart Sutra is really about zazen, which I'm sure is true. And notice, this is sort of a geeky thing, I guess, that the Heart Sutra, this version, Avalokiteshvara is speaking to Shariputra. Well, Avalokiteshvara, in this wisdom sutra, Avalokiteshvara is the bodhisattva of great compassion. And he's speaking to Shariputra, who was the foremost disciple in that sort of Abhidharma kind of listing and so on. And he's basically saying to Shariputra, no, 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 no. Let it go. Let it go. And that deep letting go wisdom, that seeing clearly the lack of own being of all dharmas, that I started to say, I'm going to say it, doctrinally maybe not so great, but that's the ground of compassion. That's the soil of compassion. And I'm talking about emptiness where there are no things. So, but you have to talk about these things somehow. So that's how I choose to talk about it. That we see As we practice, we see more and more how we create problems. And Obora has that wonderful description of, you know, coming home he traveled a lot apparently, and he always made sure that the monks knew what tram that he was coming home on and where what time it would get to the local stop and so on. And he expected somebody to meet him. And then he starts talking about, well, what if they don't? And then I'm disgruntled and I have to walk to the temple carrying my luggage. And I walk in and somebody says, and I'm you know, mumbling to myself about what slobs they are and how they don't respect me and what's going on here and doesn't anybody care and whatever. And then he walks in and then somebody says, oh, we're so sorry. We were just going to get you and an emergency came up. We're really sorry. How are you? And let me take your bag. And then all of the anger goes away. But what if he walks in and there's nobody there and nobody comes to apologize and he's really pissed and he calls for tea and somebody says, coming. And then and what is it really about, you know? But watching yourself when you do that, I mean, he was sort of describing a hypothetical, but he was also talking about himself, and you can tell that he knows these things. He knows impatience. He knows being cranky. And so do we. And if we practice Prajnaparamita, if we practice seeing clearly, we see when we're not skillful, and we see when we're being pulled around by our emotions, and we see how lousy it makes us feel, and we see how we hurt other people in the process, and we see how we hurt ourselves, and we can loosen our grip on it, and we can find that empty heart. When I was my first practice period at Tassajara, I worked in the kitchen for the 5-day sesshin during that practice period, because it was very small and they were short staffed, and I had sat, I don't know, three, I think, long sesshins already that year. So I thought, well, fine, I'll do it. And I also, I'd heard about working in the kitchen silently. So I did work in the kitchen while it wasn't silent, and I was really disappointed and felt let down and whatever. And for various reasons, the regular Kenzo was sitting that one, and his assistant was the leader in the kitchen. And I snapped at her one day. And then I felt really bad about it. And it was a real struggle to get to the point. We were studying, by the way, the Heart Sutra and talking about empty heart. Anyway, it was a real struggle to get to the point of being able to just apologize and say, I'm sorry, I was abrupt with you, or whatever it was. You know, without needing, you know, wanting to justify myself and telling her how she started it, or she triggered me, or whatever. Just to say, I'm sorry, I was rude. It was really hard. And I made it by the end. And of course, she didn't even know what I was talking about. But at any rate, then there was a, you know, Shosan, the Dharma question and answer at the end of the sesshin. And so my question to Sojin was about that. And I kind of managed to disguise it. But I said, you know, that I had been rude to somebody and I owed him an apology. And it was really, really hard to get to, felt like it cost a lot to get to an empty heart, to be able to simply apologize. And I asked if it ever got any easier. And he said, don't be stingy. Don't be stingy. And I said it cost a lot. He said, don't be stingy. So don't be stingy. This practice is liberation. And it's not so easy. It's not so easy to get to an empty heart, to get to letting go of all of our ideas, of wanting to be something. So it's 20 after, and I just want, do you have any questions or comments or whatever? Seems like it may be a lot. So you can just put your hands in Gassho if you want, and I will call on you. Barbara Joan?
Not sure if I can articulate this as a question or a comment quite, but I'll try because it rose in my mind. The experience of that emptiness and the trust in the wisdom of the self, the original organic wisdom, that's what arises when you open the hand, when you sit. So it's already there, the open heart. That's what I'm understanding, is that what you're doing is seeking the open heart by letting go of what clouds bisects your being, what creates duality. which is not that, but only this, like only what you perceive, only the chair is the chair. So if I let go, I mean, obviously the chair is going to stay a chair because I'm sitting in it. But if I let better, if I let go of my concept, then there will be the emptiness that will allow me to let go. Is that, am I understanding?
It's, well, it's, I started to say it's a little more complicated than that. I think, oh, terrible word. But it's different a little because it's more about allowing your true nature to reveal itself to you and allowing it to express, kind of getting out of the way. And we sit zazen and we pay attention and we notice the discomfort, harm, unwholesomeness, whatever word you want, that we cause by our clinging to our ideas of things. But it's not, it's not finding something. It's just allowing something. And it's not a thing, but allowing the Buddha nature, your true nature, to shine forth. And then the appropriate response comes. And it's not getting rid of your idea of a chair, because that's how, you have to have an idea of a chair in order to function, right? But you don't have to, you have to have the concept of a chair. And we all have our, we each have a different concept of a chair, a little bit different. But at any rate, you have to have a concept of a chair, but you don't have to reify it. You don't have to make it solid. You can approach, because I don't know if anybody actually lives there all the time, but you can approach resting in mere concept. Just let the chair be your idea of a chair, but don't kill it. Don't take a lot of, you know, paper mache and flour and water paste and slap all these labels on it so hard that it can't even be a chair anymore. And that you can't allow me to have a different idea or experience of that chair. I'm going to stop, because does that respond to you?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
I mean, it offers me more to consider as well.
Well, this is a lot, and I talk about that sort of notion of concepts and so on a lot. So some of the people have heard this many times, and I like to get into the dead parrot sketch, but I'm controlling myself. I'll tell you another time. Anybody else? Jody?
Yeah, I mean, I can appreciate talking about a chair and keeping it simple, I guess, to make the point. But, you know, I mean, like you said, we live in the relative world. We live in a place where there's racism and sexism and homophobia and murder and rape. And so this idea of just sort of letting, not kind of approaching things with an open, like you said, what'd you call it? The open hand of thought rather than the closed hand. I guess I'm grappling with, I find it challenging to think that I should think of racism or sexism or homophobia with an open hand. I mean, those are, that has to be held as what it is. And I guess I just, maybe I'm missing the point. I feel like I'm being told that not to fight against and fight for things that I think that are right and good in the world, so that other people can, you know, just kind of push their sort of hate and agenda. And I'm supposed to just kind of sit all peaceful and, you know, be loving, kind of compassionate with that. And I guess I'm just not there yet where I see how that can be helpful.
Well, so, the Prajnaparamita sees things as it is, and it is, there is racism and there is sexism and so on. And I am not suggesting, you know, I sometimes say people fall off into emptiness and then they get into some place where they kind of don't care. I think Obora talks about this a little bit, not in those terms exactly, but it happens. You can see there are Zen students, you know, somebody dies and they'll say, well, you know, that what's living and what's dying, there's not really a difference. We're all one. So no, I'm not upset. Well, the hell with that. You know, somebody died. And compassionate, an appropriate response may well be setting a boundary. And I think of John Lewis. One of the many wonderful things he said was that, you know, he started out sitting in at lunch counters and riding buses, you know, with just a few people. And he said that he had come to understand that he had to engage in civil disobedience. He had to stand up against this oppression, because if he didn't take action, he would not be able to love those who oppressed him if he didn't take action against them. But I don't think he would have thought of it as fighting them. But he was definitely opposing them and setting a boundary. And, you know, I don't know if he said or but he. King said, or both, you know, there's like hate the action, but not the actor. So it's not saying, you know, if some man grabs your ass, that you should just say, whoops, you know, you do what's appropriate, which might be turning around and slugging him. Might not, but at any rate, it's not about becoming passive. Is that useful? Oh, Kelly?
Yeah, this discussion reminded me, I heard this wonderful interview with George Saunders last week, the guy who wrote Lincoln and the Bardo and has a new book out, but he was talking about empathy, and he said, be empathic, but don't be so empathic that it lops off chunks of reality. he was saying you want to be empathic, but there are some things that you have to fight.
Yeah, but where is it coming from? You know, there's a story that quoting the Buddha from long ago, and the commentator, I guess it's Buddha Gosa, says that Buddha said, you are not my disciple if you go out in a boat with some other people and a sea pirate stops your boat and boards it and says, I'm going to take one of you. I need an oarsman. You are not my disciple if you say, take me, I'll go. And I chewed on that one for quite a while. Because isn't that what a bodhisattva is supposed to do? And what I came to was, you just go. There's no take me, I'll go. There's no just go, which is hard to imagine. But it's a good, I think it's a really useful image. Just go. But it doesn't, it, you know, nobody's saying that you should sit there because I don't get to say, take me, I'll go, that I should just sit there and let them take Ralph. So I think it's time to stop. And we can talk about this. And we're, Steve and I are going to be giving the lectures in March, and we'll be talking about some of this stuff, you know, from a slightly different perspective. So jump in if you want. So we do the beings are numberless. I vow to save them. We'll do that, but just once through the four vows. Okay?
Yeah.
Mary?
Yes?
Is there anything in particular we should read before next week?
Oh, we're going to cover, Steve is going to cover, where's the thing? Basically, the big, Musong has it in paragraphs, which makes it easier to, because we have it, we never have any punctuation. The for that big paragraph, Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness.
What page is that, Mary?
It's page five of, it's the Heart Sutra. It's it's just that I'm looking at one that's in paragraphs. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They don't appear or disappear. There's no form, no feelings, no perceptions, mm-hmm. no impulses, no eyes, no ears, no ignorance, and no suffering, no origination, and mm-hmm. so on. That's the part that is, in shorthand, listing the basic teachings. It's the skandhas, it's the circle of dependent origination, it's the Four Noble Truths, it's the what did we wind up calling the 18?
The elements.
The elements, okay. And so you can find the, they're in Musong, it's separated into sections. So you can, it starts on page 19. And I didn't directly address that, this coursing in the Prajnaparamita, seeing things as it is, you're saved from suffering and distress. But I think it was implicit in a lot of what I said, that the more we can, this is Uchiyama's phrase, open the hand of thought, there's much less distress because there's not the protection of the idea of a separate self. And we can talk about this more. Okay. Somebody want to do a stop?
Yeah, I will do it if you, and also I wanted to add that please do look, keep your emails. I was going to say keep them open. No, that's not what I mean. Keep an eye out. I'll be sending you more handouts. Over the weekend, there'll be more from the Obora book, which is the Tiger's Cave. You don't have to buy it, but if you have it, that's good too. But there'll be handouts from that and anything else to prepare. And so you want me to say the all beings? I mean, the beings are numberless. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.